Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On March 27th, the Trump administration ended collective bargaining rights for more than 1 million federal workers. One of today's guests, labor historian Joseph McCartin, says it's the largest and most aggressive single act of union busting in U.S. history. The attack on federal workers began with the gutting of federal agencies by DOGE. Trump's push to dismantle the Department of Labor and push for deregulation will leave workers more vulnerable and less safe at work. The reduction of the federal minimum wage for federal contractors and the cancellation of union contracts will impact hundreds of thousands of federal workers. According to the Economic Policy Institute's 100 Days, 100 Ways report on labor, the administration has taken steps to make most U.S. workers and their families substantially poorer in the coming years. Trump has rescinded an executive order that gave 390,000 low-wage federal contractors a living wage, terminated Department of Labor grants that fight forced and child labor and promote workers' rights, delayed the enforcement of a rule intended to protect coal miners from exposure to silica, and much more. Economists are also warning of the negative impacts Trump's immigration policies are having on the labor market. So how are people across the country responding? Well, nationwide protests are planned for Labor Day. Joining us to discuss the state of the labor movement under Trump are three guests. Victor Naro is lecturer in law at UCLA and project director for the UCLA Labor Center. Victor Naro has taught at UCLA for 22 years. He's a nationally known expert on the workplace rights of immigrant workers. Over the past few years, he's worked with the Los Angeles labor movement on major immigration worker organizing campaigns with janitors, hotel workers, laundry workers, sanitation workers, port truckers, and the Clean Car Wash campaign. Victor Naro's latest book is called The Activist Spirit: Toward a Radical Solidarity. Hi, Victor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. John Logan is professor and department chair of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. John Logan is an expert on the anti-union industry and anti-union legislation in the U.S., particularly with a focus on how multinational companies treat employees and unions differently in the United States compared to European countries. He's published widely on U.S. and international labor issues and has conducted research on unions in over 40 countries. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us. Is John with us? All right, we'll connect with John in a minute.
Hi, Rose.
Hi, John. Thanks for joining us. We're also joined by Joseph McCartin, professor of history and founding executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. Professor Joseph McCartin is an expert on U.S. labor, social, and political history. He's taught at Georgetown for 26 years. Professor McCartin is author of Labor's Great War: The Struggle for Industrial Democracy and the Origins of Modern American Labor Relations, and Collision Course: Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Joseph McCartin is president of the Labor and Working Class History Association and contributing editor to Labor, Studies and Working Class History. Hi, Joseph. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to start off with you, Joe, because you wrote an entire book about Ronald Reagan and what he did to the air traffic controllers. And yet you're saying that the Trump administration ending collective bargaining rights for more than a million federal workers is the largest and most aggressive single act of union busting in U.S. history?
That's right, Rose. Certainly what Ronald Reagan did in his time and taking the aggressive approach he took to the walkout of air traffic controllers, who, as your listeners, I'm sure know, are federal employees working for the FAA. They did not have a right to strike in 1981. And when they did strike in violation of the law, Reagan gave them an ultimatum. If you don't return to work in 48 hours, you will be fired and replaced. They didn't return, and he followed through on that ultimatum. That had a devastating impact on the union movement of that time and after. More, I would say, on the private sector even than on federal workers or other public workers, because it sort of showed a green light to the corporate interests in the 1980s that they too could emulate Reagan in being aggressive and strike breaking. And that's in fact what happened. So to say that Trump has gone much further and more aggressively than Reagan, I think is saying a lot, but that's the fact. One key difference between what Reagan did and what Trump is currently doing is that while Reagan broke the PATCO union, he'd never turned on collective bargaining wholesale in the federal government. In fact, before he left office, his administration recognized a successor union at the FAA, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, NATCA. They're still there to this day. Reagan never did what Trump has effectively done and tried to use a loophole in the law to declare that all kinds of federal workers should not have a right to collectively bargain because of their impact on national security. It's a transparently false way of framing what he's doing. It's a highly political act, and it's intended to do what in fact is happening right now, to deunionize the federal government. And so, yes, this is the most large scale effort to break a union presence that we've seen in our national history.
Joe, I think what's interesting about this is because so many people have left their jobs at the federal government, and because so many important government agencies have been hollowed out, I don't think that this piece has gotten much attention, that for more than a million federal workers, Trump ended collective bargaining rights and union protections. Just because so much is happening so fast, some people might even be surprised to learn this. So can you talk a little bit more about what this means exactly and what precedent it sets?
I think you're exactly right, First Rose, that I think the public is not that tuned in to this part of what's occurred. Yes, they've heard about the layoffs, the closing of agencies like the CFPB, the Consumer Protection Board, but they aren't that aware of what's happened to collective bargaining. And I think that there are multiple reasons for that. One is the one you cite, that one of the things this administration has done is it's sort of taken a shotgun approach and fired out as many lethal pellets as possible to attack so many rights, so many precedents, so many things that used to be the norms in our system of politics that it's been hard for people to digest. I think part of another reason why the public isn't that aware of it, though, is that so few Americans today, even in comparison to Reagan's time, have collective bargaining themselves. So over 20% of U.S. workers still had collective bargaining in 1981 when the PATCO strike happened. Recently, it's about 9%. So we've seen a slow but steady deunionization of the country since the Reagan era. John Logan, our fellow panelist here, has done a lot to document all of that. And I think because the union presence has diminished so much, a lot of people don't even understand what it is to lose collective bargaining rights. But basically, it's converted federal workers, along with the attacks that Trump has made on the civil service system itself, it's converted federal workers into what we call at-will employees. They can be fired at any time, in effect, and for any cause or for no cause at all. And that's to be suddenly thrust into that status is one of the devastating precedents that's being set right now. And again, what happened in the PATCO era, its importance extended well beyond the air traffic controllers. You could argue that air traffic controllers, in a way, were better in the long run because of what happened in the PATCO strike. The successor union that came in won many of the things that PATCO had been fighting for. Air traffic controllers are much better paid now in comparison to what they were at that time. And there have been improvements in the system, but it was outside of the air traffic controllers that the devastating impacts of PATCO were most evident. And I think that we, you know, what I fear is that we'll see that it's well beyond the federal workforce that we start to see the impact of this deunionization being felt.
That is Joseph McCartan, professor of history and founding executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor.
Kalmanovitz, thank
Kalmanovitz,
you.
Thank you.
You did it. You do. It's so hard. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. I got to spell that out so I get it right next time. Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University, longtime labor historian. John Logan is professor and department chair of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. John, you have a piece coming out in International Union Rights, and you also say that this is the biggest single union busting act in U.S. history. You write that in the first 6 months of this year, the Trump administration has ripped a gaping hole in the heart of the labor movement, exposing its vulnerability both to anti-union executive orders and to right-wing populism. How do you see the first 7 months under Trump and what it means for labor in this country?
Yeah, you know, a couple of days ago, I was speaking to Jazz Bruzak, who started the Starbucks Workers United campaign. Jazz said it was 4 years exactly since that campaign went public. And, you know, it's almost difficult to remember now what a hopeful period like 2022-23 was for the labor movement. Those campaigns, in particularly Starbucks, but also Amazon, sort of breathed new life into the entire labor movement. And, you know, people were beginning to think that, you know, for the first time, you know, people like me thought, wow, you know, maybe there is a path to revitalization of the labor movement. Now, you know, that seems like a century ago. You know, the sort of vibe around the labor movement has just changed so dramatically. Everything just seems so, you know, incredibly despondent right now. And you know, for three, I mean, there's different problems. I'll be very quick about this. In the private sector, I mean, this is a long running problem. But, you know, what we saw, even with Starbucks and Amazon, was that any company, no matter how progressive its reputation, is prepared to do almost anything, lawful or unlawful, in order to crush efforts by its workers to organize and to get collective bargaining. That's only going to be made much worse now that we have a non-functioning National Labor Relations Board at the moment. But, you know, assuming eventually that we get people confirmed, we'll have a National Labor Relations Board that's very hostile to workers' rights. Second, as Joe said, in the federal sector, but I think this new attack, as Joe said, won't stop at federal workers. It will continue most likely first into the public sector as a whole, particularly I think with teachers' unions. It has really shown the underlying vulnerabilities of the labor movement that, you know, that you can get this administration that doesn't play by the rules, it doesn't care about the rule of law, constitution, separation of powers. And, you know, almost at the stroke of a pen, you know, Trump signs an executive order in March, and that lays the basis for, you know, over 2% of the labor movement to lose its collective bargaining rights. And the third thing, which I think is really important, as you mentioned, is that we're now facing, you know, this is not the old Republican Party. I mean, we can discuss the extent to which this is real, where it's a real threat to the labor movement. But people like J.D. Vance, Josh Hawley, Marco Rubio, even Trump himself, I mean, Trump's all over the place, but are quite serious about the right-wing populism and, their economic nationalism, protectionism, tariffs, anti-immigration rhetoric. And it's impossible to deny that that has widespread appeal amongst union members and for some certain unions in the labor movement. I mean, people like Holly don't want to destroy the Teamsters or the steel workers or the building trades. They want to co-opt them. They want to make them into Trump unions or, MAGA unions or however you want to describe it. And so that threat of a split, effectively a split in the labor movement, I think is very real. And I think that also does not get enough attention. We can see it obviously in unions like the Teamsters, but you can see it in the building trades. You can see it even in the UAW with its left leadership that's been very complimentary about Trump's tariffs. The labor movement is really fighting for its survival, I think, over the next 4 years. It will still be there in 4 years' time, but it might be a very, very different labor movement from the labor movement we have today.
John, since you brought up Starbucks and Amazon, we were doing so many labor shows over the last few years because of what you just laid out. As you write in your latest piece, young workers were inspired by victories. It set off an unprecedented organizing wave at Trader Joe's, REI, Apple stores, Barnes and Noble, Chipotle, and lesser-known brands. Graduate students, undergrads, cultural workers, journalists, tech workers, video game designers, and so many others. What are you hearing from the people who have organized at these different companies and organizations? And then the other thing I've been thinking about is now that the CEOs and the leaders of these organizations know that Trump is in office, how does that change the way they deal with workers and the right to organize?
Really good question. I think, the sort of optimistic answer is the underlying conditions that gave rise to that organizing wave that we saw in 2022, 2023, are still there. Young workers with frustrated economic expectations, young workers who are, politicized differently from previous generations of young workers who are more skeptical about the sort of brutal aspects of US-style capitalism, young workers, many of whom were radicalized by working through the pandemic and then saw, victories at Starbucks and Amazon, not just that they won against those companies that we might have thought were invincible before, but the way they won with these grassroots campaigns that in many ways happened not because of the labor movement, but almost despite the labor movement. All of that's continuing, and it's just going to be a far more difficult environment. And then, as you say, what about the people who run these companies? I think the tech companies are a particularly interesting example. When we saw those spectacles of like Zuckerberg and Tim Cook and, the CEO of Google, sort of debasing themselves in front of Trump, you think, why do they do this? They don't like this guy. We know they don't like this guy. And, you could say that, well, it's about a fiduciary responsibility to the company. They have to do whatever they think is necessary in order to allow their company to make money in this new environment. And, they have particular concerns about, Biden, about antitrust efforts and so forth. But I think the labor question was really key. I mean, what we saw at these tech companies and all over, at Starbucks, at Amazon, was a generation of young workers who were saying, no, we should have some say in the way this company is run, whether it be over labor issues, which were central, Palestine, the environment, LGBTQ rights, pay equity, Black Lives Matter, etc. And, these tech people, the tech barons, I think were really, they were shook to their, they really, they were shaken to their core because of this. They're like, no, We run these companies. And so someone like Trump, it's easy, I think, to understand why they would get behind someone like that, because, Trump is like the strong man. So it says, yes, we're back in charge now. So I do think actually the sort of labor response, we see ongoing, at Microsoft, workers protesting over Palestine. We saw it at many of the tech companies. I think that was really central to understanding why so many of those tech people, it's not just economics. I mean, of course, they're, part of the billionaire class, but, say, I think that the labor issues are really central. But say the underlying conditions that gave rise to these organizing waves are still there. The young workers who want to organize in tech and food services and, what Noam Shriver, New York Times, called the revolt of the college-educated working class, who are in these low-wage jobs in food services and retail, and who want to organize their co-workers, want to have an independent voice. That's still there. It's just going to be far more difficult in this environment to achieve those types of organizing victories. And unfortunately, I think the labor movement and labor leaders are not really cut out for this kind of moment. I mean, they're not able to resist. They basically sat in the sidelines while all of this organizing was going on in many ways. And now they're facing this sort of full frontal attack from the federal government. And quite frankly, they don't seem to know how to respond.
And we'll talk about that after a break. That is John Logan, Professor and Department Chair of Labor and Employment Studies at San Francisco State University. On today's Your Call, we're talking about the state of the labor movement under Trump. We're also joined by Victor Naro, lecturer in law at UCLA and project director for the UCLA Labor Center. Victor, you have worked with janitors, hotel workers, laundry workers, sanitation workers, port truck workers, and car wash workers, and oh gosh, about 2 months ago, we talked with someone with the Clean Car Wash campaign, and they told us about the ICE raids that were happening at car washes in Los Angeles. So many of the workers that you have worked with, not only are they now dealing with an anti-worker administration, but they're also dealing with ICE and deportations. So what are you hearing from people you are working with?
Well, this is what we've been talking about up to now is part of the Project 2025 playbook. And, the attacks, I know Joe mentioned that all the attacks coming from different directions. And this is, Project 2025 being put into action by this administration and his cabinet. But we are fighting back. And I just want to, workers are under attack, especially in Los Angeles, been that military occupation. And this summer, we've been fighting the National Guard, the U.S. Marines, all these federal agencies combined, immigration enforcement happening with, based on racial profiling. People are just being picked off the streets and interrogated and then disappeared. And it's kidnapping and disappeared because everybody's wearing a mask. They're not even showing identification. So we're fighting back collectively. So the labor movement in LA is really closely aligned with the immigrant rights movement. We're fighting back against the attack of the immigrant workers. LA City Hall has become a place of bold activism from elected leaders to fight back as well. We have a sanctuary policy, but we are actually moving forward other initiatives in city council. The most recent one is we want to demand that they, require them to identify themselves and to show their faces and identify who they are, because we have masked men with huge weapons, arsenals, walking around LA and just picking off workers. And I just want the workers themselves, I mean, I'm talking about the day laborers, car wash workers, the street vendors, the open air workers are the ones that are being attacked because those are visible workers, those are the workers out there in public. They've become really, through these attacks, a champion of our First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, and Fifth Amendment rights under the Constitution. They've become the vanguard for our constitutional rights. And they're not just disappear. The workers are not hiding away. You have day laborers that still continue to go to the Home Depots. You have car wash workers that still continue to go to the car washes to provide the services every day. And we have rapid response. We have monitoring. We have organizers from different social justice work, from labor, immigrant rights, and other movements at every Home Depot, every car wash out there. We have patrols. So we're fighting back, and we're not like hiding away. And we're hoping LA can become the epicenter of how to fight back hard against this administration. And, it's been a summer of fear, a summer of uncertainty, but it's been a summer of deep, radical solidarity. Mm. I mean, we have so much energy, and our energy is also coming from young people. I mean, young people in this country, millennials and Gen Zs, they want a strong labor movement. They really have a high favorability of labor in this country, and they're out there on the streets with us in Los Angeles in the fight back. So there's a reason why Trump has singled Los Angeles out as that city that he wants to really win the fight, because I think in some ways we are fighting back in a way that's very effective. And I think that's become a thorn on this administration. But I'm hoping what happens in Los Angeles creates a spark with other parts of the country of how the labor unions, immigrant rights, social justice work can get together and fight back on the streets.
Victor, before we go to break, can you elaborate on what that solidarity and organizing looks like? Because what I'm hearing from listeners and just people out on the streets is they don't know what to do under this administration. They don't know what kind of organizing works in this climate. What would you say to them?
So we have a, I think most major cities now have a rapid response network. We have one that's very well organized in Los Angeles through the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles. But, the Chula Rapid Response Network is then connected with other rapid response network. For example, I'm part of the Democratic Socialists of America. DSA branches in Los Angeles have adopted every Home Depot. So Home Depot, you have DSA members, you have immigrant rights community members. And then these networks are also connected with the community. So the average person out there who's not connected with any of these organizations but wants to get involved, there's a way for them to get involved. So a lot of this is really on the ground networking and solidarity building. They're doing it in the other cities. The other cities are creating these kind of networks. These networks are often under the radar screen because the media doesn't report on them enough. But there is strong ground roots network coalition building happening in some of the major cities to protect the rights of immigrants, to fight back against the kidnapping and disappearing that's been happening. And so it is happening. It's just every city has a different type of rapid response networking that's taking place.
We're going to take a quick break. Victor Naro is lecturer in law at UCLA and project director for the UCLA Labor Center. He has worked on many campaigns with janitors, hotel workers, laundry workers, sanitation workers, and the Clean Car Wash campaign. His latest book is called The Activist Spirit: Toward a Radical Solidarity. John Logan is professor and department chair of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. John is an expert on the anti-union industry and anti-union legislation in the U.S. He's conducted research on unions in over 40 countries. Joseph McCartan is professor of history and founding executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. Professor McCartan is author of Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. He's also president of the Labor and Working Class History Association. On today's Your Call, we're talking about the state of the labor movement under the Trump administration. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our new series, The Authoritarian Playbook, with Professor Barbara Walter. Her new book is How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. We'll talk about Trump's threats to send National Guard troops to Chicago, Baltimore, Oakland, and San Francisco. We should also say that some troops in D.C. are now armed. We hope you can join us for our new series tomorrow. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the state of the labor movement under Trump, if you've been involved in organizing, what are you hearing from your coworkers? If you have been affected by any of Trump's actions, he's taken a lot since January. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And just a reminder, because this hasn't really gotten that much attention because so much is happening so fast, in late March, Trump ended collective bargaining rights and union protections for more than 1 million federal workers. And Joseph McCartin, who wrote a whole book on what happened with Ronald Reagan and the air traffic controllers, says what Trump did is the largest and most aggressive single act of union busting in U.S. history. So we have about 20 minutes left, and I'd love to hear you all talk about what has happened with union members and the Democratic Party. Because first off, it's so important to remember that, let me find this article here. I just want to get this right. So Teamsters President Sean O'Brien spoke at the Republican National Convention in July. And of course, this was huge news because you don't have pro-union presidents speaking at the RNC. So that happened. And the Democrats just over time have lost so many workers. The New York Times has a piece about this. And Jimmy Williams, the president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, said, "Every time we talk politics, the first thing that comes up is the Democrats let us down." Jimmy Williams said his 140,000 members split nearly evenly between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. You know, even though they knew what Trump did the first time around. So, Joe, what are your thoughts about the Democratic Party and labor?
Well, Rose, that story has been long in the making. John referred to the fact that the Trump administration doesn't want to destroy the Teamsters or some of the building trades unions. It wants to co-opt them. Trump isn't the first Republican president to adopt that strategy. Richard Nixon did it. At the end of the 60s and 1970, some people who know the history of that period might remember the quote-unquote hard hat riot, where construction workers who were angry at anti-war protesters engaged in a street scuffle with them in New York. And Nixon embraced those construction workers as the voice of the silent majority. And he tried to appeal to unions to come over to his side, which was, he argued, more patriotic, and that they agreed on values. Reagan did the same thing in reaching out to unions. In fact, the day that he was shot by John Hinckley, he was speaking to a meeting of building trades unionists at a Washington hotel. He didn't want to destroy the union movement so much as co-opt it. Unfortunately, in the years since Reagan, the Democratic Party drifted and drifted from its New Deal orientation, which was an enthusiastic embrace for a time of the union cause, in the direction of what became known as the New Democrats or the Atari Democrats, the Clinton Democratic Party, which embraced things like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, over labor's objections. And the Democratic Party became more identified with things like free trade than it did with worker rights. And when the Great Recession struck, and then when the country never really emerged from it strongly, I think more and more working class voters started to, you know, blame the Democratic Party for having given up on them. And the Democrats left themselves, I think, wide open to a right-wing populist appeal. And one of the things Trump got right at the beginning was to criticize NAFTA strongly, And that resonated with many working class voters. And so Democrats left themselves open to this. The Biden administration, I think, tried to engage in a course correction on that. We don't have time to go into great detail on it, but Biden did a lot of things to try to be a pro-worker, pro-union president. Arguably, he was the most pro-union president that we've had, but it was a day late and a dollar short, I think, in terms of inspiring confidence from working people. And when you look at what happened to prices in the last year of the Biden administration and workers feeling like the cost of living was getting out of hand, I think it just left the door wide open for Trump's return.
John, what would you add? According to some early polling right after the election, a vote cast looked at the AP and Fox, and they found that union members voted for Harris by 57%, and then Trump got 41%. So what this, like Joe said, this is a longstanding story, but
yeah.
You've heard a lot of people who stayed home because they felt like the Democrats
right.
didn't have a solid working class message.
And in fact, other accounts put Trump's share of the union vote at quite a bit higher, about 45 to 53. And as you quoted for the painters union, you know, in certain sections of the labor movement, there's no question that Trump has majority support. And keep in mind, this is after the labor movement has spent hundreds of millions of dollars trying to convince their members to vote in a different way. So it's just not working. I know you had Joan Williams on a few weeks ago, who has an excellent book out about, you know, how Democrats lost the working class and how to win them back. But, you know, it's really difficult. It's, the fundamental problem is that, you know, the where Trump wins a lot of his support, the economy that sustained a middle-class lifestyle for blue-collar workers has fallen apart far more quickly than most people anticipated. And neither Democrats nor Republicans have any solution as to how to rebuild a sustainable economy in those parts of the country. And that makes people vulnerable to a sort of populist demagogue like Trump riding in his white horse saying, I have the solution to your problems, you know, tariffs, economic nationalism, anti-immigration. I will fix your problems. I am your retribution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the important thing is it's not just happening in the US. I mean, native-born working class have moved to right-wing. You know, I'm from Scotland originally. My family's from Ireland. But, you know, in the UK at the moment, all over the country, you're getting protests outside of hotels that are being used to house asylum seekers. And, you know, we're one election away in the UK from having a far-right populist, Nigel Farage, probably as prime minister. So, but this is happening all over. You know, in the US, yeah, it's a huge, huge problem. And when you need real leadership in the labor movement. And I don't think we've had that leadership. It's easy to blame the labor establishment. I realize that. But, I in the piece you quoted, I sort of compare the labor movement in some ways to universities. You know, say, like universities, they've become far too dependent on support from federal and state governments. Like the universities, the heads of the organizations are not well equipped for the moment that they find themselves in. These are the times that we need real leadership from the labor movement that can explain to people, you know, people like, you know, I don't want to just go back to the same old names, but people like Sherrod Brown in Ohio, or maybe Dan Osborne in Nebraska, who can explain to people, yes, the Democrats have failed you in many ways, and your anger is justified. But right-wing populism is not the answer. That will simply make things worse. One other thing, Rose, and I'll stop. You rightly said a lot of people feel hopeless and, you know, powerless and don't know what to do, you know, how to fight back against this sort of proto-fascism that we read about every day that seems to be growing stronger and stronger. Organizing at your workplace is a concrete thing you can do to resist authoritarianism. Now, the problem is, of course, that your workers by themselves, so many young workers would like to do this. They need to, people who can give them the tools with which to succeed. But organizing at your workplace is perhaps the single most practical thing one could do in this moment that would be a meaningful step to fighting against, it's not even creeping authoritarianism, it's a wave of authoritarianism that we see every day.
Victor, what would you like to add? You know, the other thing that the president of the Painters Union said in a CBS interview is that he's heard from his members, they are so angry about their plight. Their wages are stagnant, they're having a hard time making ends meet, that they just said, I'm going to vote for the guy who wants to blow up the system. So what are your thoughts? What would you like to add?
Yeah, well, I want to follow, in addition to answering the question, I also want to follow up to John's great comments right now. I just think, I was recently at the Democratic Socialism of America Convention, and the major emphasis for 3 days was political education and organizing in the workplace. And, you know, there were a lot of panels of rank and file union members. These are union members themselves that figure out the strategy, how to politicize their workplace, how to politicize the labor movement, how to bring organizing and political education back into the movement to the level where we could have create a systemic change. It's great to have the alignment with the Democratic Party, but I feel like we cannot fully depend on the Democratic Party to save the labor movement. We had to take that into our own hands as the working class, as rank and file. So there was a lot of emphasis on that. And I think I was uplifted because I saw rank and file members already doing this great work in different parts of the country. We just got to invest in that. That's the leadership, I think, follow up on Joe. Comment. That's the leadership that I think we need to invest in, is the rank and file leadership. And then, we need to convert to social justice unionism. I think historically labor movement, I think the weakness has been business unionism, just stay with the status quo. But when you look at Los Angeles, New York City, and Chicago, the unions that are making a difference are these social justice unions, like United HRA, Local 11, and also SEIU. And then I think the labor movement is broader now because of all these organizing happening in non-union industries. So we also have to invest and support there's 300 worker centers in this country. They are trying to organize workers, because these are workers that don't have the benefit of a collective bargaining agreement, but they want to organize for better conditions. So we have to keep investing in the worker centers. The National Day Labor Organizing Network is at the forefront on taking on Home Depot and ICE. And so we have to support that National Worker Center. And so we all have to come together and fight for the right to organize. I think, what's at risk is democracy, the labor movement, the Constitution, but also the lives of workers. Because they're working, if you have deterioration of labor standards in this country and health and safety standards, labor violations, it impacts the lives of workers to the level. You're talking about life and death situations.
Victor, I think what you're saying is so important because if you would ask people across the country, how much do you think 70% of the country makes? I bet they would get it wrong. So if you look at the Economic Policy Institute and numbers from the UC Berkeley Labor Center, 40% of workers earn less than $15 an hour, 30% earn less than $25,000 a year. So, so many people in this country are low-wage earners and struggle to make ends meet.
Yeah, and the pandemic highlighted this, and this is why you had the great American resignation after the pandemic. People didn't want to go back to their jobs. The quality of life concept is very ingrained now in the working classes. You should not have to work two or three jobs just to survive economically. That's not good for your quality of life, but it's not good for your health, and this, and it leads to all kinds of illnesses and other harm. We should all be together, united in the concept that you should only have one job, and that one job, no matter where it is, what industry, you should only have one job that affords you the quality of life. But that means, the cost of living issue, the housing, it's all interrelated. We have to like be in a fight to against poverty, against the rise in the cost of housing and how to create affordable housing. But I think if anything we're learning in the past few months is that we need to break the silos of being in different movements, and we need to come together as a united movement, because so much is at stake. And and we have to do this now. We cannot wait until the midterm elections. I think the midterm election is important for that political landscape in Congress, but we need to begin this kind of broad, massive base building movement right now.
Victor Naro is lecturer in law at UCLA. John Logan is professor at San Francisco State. Joseph McCartin is professor at Georgetown University. Let's take a few callers and then we'll get final thoughts from all of you. Let's go to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Thanks for holding.
Hi, good morning, Rose. Good morning, your guests. I was a former employee at REI, and I wanted a union from the day I walked in the door there. I worked there for 8 years and 3 months. They came up with trumped up charges to get rid of me because they knew I wanted a union, and they knew I was trying to get people organized. But I just want to say one thing to throw at you guys is they used a union-busting law firm called Morgan, Lewis & Bucaius, LLP. I believe they're out of Washington, D.C. Those kind of firms that consult with management and work with management and go to the labor relations board representing the company, they have to be done away with. Until we find ways to make those kind of firms illegal for what they do, because that firm, too, I think works for Amazon, and I think they've done work for Walmart. They're a real problem for workers trying to organize. And you know that firms like REI use a divide and conquer. They really push the younger workers versus more established workers. They push this Black Indigenous people of color, saying that unions are against that. Unions are racist and whatnot, and they don't pull this out of their rear ends. They're getting this kind of stuff, and the stuff they push on the workers, the people that really don't understand unions, and a lot of people don't. I grew up in a union household. My father was a UAW worker. Everybody in my family was in a union when I grew up during the 40s and 50s, 60s. This is ridiculous. That's my comment. You guys got any questions for me? I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, but KQED had a piece about what you're just explaining in April. Frustrated Berkeley REI workers accuse co-op of union busting and straying from values. I'm sure a lot of people are just curious. We're almost out of time, but we'll do another show about this. What response did you get from management around trying to organize? I mean, you said they tried to push
No
you out.
way. Oh, they're totally 100% against unions. 100% against it. They want nothing to do with unions. No way. And you always think of REI. I always thought had a positive view of the company. But when you're in the inside, of course, it's always a whole different thing. The wages were awful. It took me 3.5 years just to become full-time.
Wow.
I always wanted to be a full-time employee. It took me 3.5 years. They started me at $11.40 an hour. You think you can live in the Bay Area at $11.40 an hour? And I would get as many hours as I could possibly get. I could get up to 35, almost 40 hours a week because I'd sub for somebody else at the last minute. It's not an easy life.
Yeah.
And
well,
I worked
right.
myself up to over $25 an hour when they got rid of me.
Andy, would you mind giving Kevin your phone number? Because we'll definitely do a show about this and we'd love to connect with you. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but we'll definitely do a show. Thank you for the call. We're almost out of time, but Judy, why don't you get the last word, because you want to talk about the Labor Day March this weekend.
Yeah, in San Francisco, it's at 11 a.m. at the 16th and Mission BART Plaza, and it's going to a short march to Dolores Park. And, you know, unions, non-union people who want to be in unions, go. Make it big.
Well, thank you. And if you want to find out more, there's a website called maydaystrong.org, and they are organizing marches and rallies all over the country. There are, it looks like, thousands of communities across the country are taking a stand on Labor Day. We're almost out of time. Joe, you've been at this for a long time. What are your final thoughts about where you think the labor movement is going, especially over the next 3 or so years?
Well, Rose, I would say that we're at an inflection point. This is one of those times in history that, you know, 100 years from now, I think people will look back on. The question is, what kind of inflection point? I think we're facing a really, really dangerous situation with the erosion of our democracy, along with the, you know, all-out effort that we've been talking about here to weaken one of democracy's real pillars, which is workers' ability to organize and to bargain for themselves. So there's a lot of reasons for optimism, as we've heard here from people like Victor, about what's happening at the grassroots, et cetera. All that's true. At the same time, John pointed out that labor's leadership has really yet to step up with a way to bring people together around a resistance strategy. That's also true. So this is an important moment of truth. And what happens in the next few years, I think, will determine what happens for the next 30 or more. Mm.
Joseph McCartan is professor of history and founding executive director of the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. John Logan is professor and department chair of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. Victor Naro is lecturer in law at UCLA and project director for the UCLA Labor Center. Victor, John, and Joseph, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can learn more about their work and then find articles about what we discussed today. KALW.org, click news, and then your call. Be sure to podcast our show, share it with friends, family, and colleagues. And we hope you can join us for our new series tomorrow, The Authoritarian Playbook. Thanks to Johanna Miyake for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.